Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter. Before we start the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Cook Political Report. If you're interested in more of our great content, consider subscribing. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. The offer is available only to new subscribers. Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. Back in the 2012 election cycle, Chauncey McClain was a young staffer on the Obama campaign, working in the newly developing field of data analytics. 6 years later, Chauncey put those data science skills and ones he developed while working in the private sector testing ads for commercial products to work as head of the Democratic Super PAC Future Forward. Now, most outside super PACs like these do an extensive amount of polling and survey work and bring in multiple outside advisors to help manage and produce campaign ads and other material. What makes Future Forward unique is the tremendous amount of survey data and ad testing that they do. Its team of data scientists surveyed millions of voters, tested thousands of ads, with the goal of finding and airing the ads that moved the needle the most with the voters. Now, during 2024, the group poured about $800 million into ads that supported first Joe Biden and then Kamala Harris's campaign for president. At the end of the day, of course, the Trump campaign's advertising and media strategy, in particular, Trump's ability to connect with younger men via social media platforms like podcasts and YouTube, was the more successful. And lots of folks, including many Democrats, point to the Trump campaign ad that attacked Harris for supporting taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners as being particularly effective. So now, as the Democratic Party struggles to find its footing, I wanted to talk to Chauncey about what he learned from Harris's loss and how Democratic groups like his are adapting to this fractured media environment going forward. Chauncey typically keeps a low profile. This is apparently his very first ever podcast. So I'm very happy he agreed to this interview. We recorded the conversation on Wednesday, March 19th. Chauncey McClain, hello.
Hello, Amy. Nice to be here.
I'm very happy to have you here. As I understand it, this is your first podcast. Is that true?
I think that's right. I think this is it. First time for everything.
We are very happy for that, honored by this moment, you choosing to talk with me. For those who don't know you and don't understand or know what Future Forward is, if you could explain that. And I'd also like to have you react specifically to something the New York Times said about you all, which is you're an ad-making lab masquerading as a super PAC.
Yeah, it's interesting. I somehow remember that that headline. Funny enough. I won't go too far back, but I'll tell my story a little bit because I think it relates to what kind of organization we started at Future Forward. So way back in 2011, 2012, I was on the advertising team for the Obama reelect. Working with folks you've never heard of, like David Axelrod, where I just, learned, was just a sponge and learned a ton. But coming out of that campaign, I started a media analytics startup called AMG that was really focused in the consumer space. We became known for doing, randomized controlled trials for consumer brands to measure the impact of their advertising. And not to get too wonky, but a randomized controlled trial is just what drug companies use to measure the efficacy of a new drug, right? There's a treatment group, there's a control group. 1,000 people see the receive the treatment. 1,000 people don't. We measure the difference in movement in the treatment group, and we can say that this is due to the ad, right? And so I did that for 3 years. I sold the company in a bittersweet moment in November of 2016, when Trump gets elected. And so we started Future Forward with the idea of bringing some of these tools and some of this rigor that we saw in consumer marketing back to the political space. Then you get to 2020, and to my great surprise, we raised $200 million as a bunch of nobodies that no one's ever heard of. And we're the largest outside advertiser for Joe Biden in that election. And then from there, it's all a whirlwind until 2023, when we were asked to be the official outside group for Biden. And then we were the same for Harris. And, you know, I don't think it's quite right to say that we're a, you know, ad testing laboratory masquerading as a super PAC. I would say that, you know, a closer approximation is we are a giant research operation. And we just do two things. We conduct a ton of voter research. We want to understand what voters think about everything in real time. Ad testing is one tool we have in our toolbox, but by no means the only one. And then we run advertising programs based on that research.
And how much did you end up spending this cycle?
Yeah, so this cycle we spent about $500 million out of the PAC on advertising.
Just on advertising?
Just on advertising.
So your overall spend, though, again, for everything else that you do, whether it's advertising, it's the polling, all of that mm-hmm. is included in that number?
Yeah, all of, okay. You know, the more or less, that's the top line number.
Okay.
You know, people, you see larger numbers floating around out there, but, you know, and this is a level of granularity that people don't usually reach for because it is so paint peeling and it's boredom. But, you know, we have a 501c4, we have a super PAC, you know, those are different entities. They have different objectives. They have different goals. But the main thing we did in terms of trying to, you know, impact the election was through our super PAC. And that was a $500 million advertising spend.
And so you guys were the largest advertiser in the election.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's again, and I won't, again, I mean, we're going to lose listeners by the minute here if I get too far in the weeds. But, you know, as you know, Amy, there's the amount of money you spend to acquire the advertising. But in, you know, when you buy television advertising, for example, the campaigns get lowest unit rate.
Right, right. So as a raw number, you're exactly right. You may not have had as many ads on as, say, the Harris campaign or the Trump campaign, but you spent more money than they did.
And critically, you know, there is no, you know, lowest unit rate on digital, right? And so we were the largest political advertiser, you know, on YouTube and other similar platforms ever. You know, we spent a tremendous amount of money on YouTube and on social and in those spaces. But those numbers get a little wonky to compare them apples to apples because, you know, TV is a component of the spend and there you have LUR.
Okay, for those, and granted, we are talking to a pretty wonky audience, but let's, for those who are a little less wonky and a little less politically plugged in, just walk us through this process, because the way I understood it was, as you said, you guys have so much data, you're talking to so many voters, and what you're essentially doing is taking all of that data, putting it into a message, right? We have all this data about what voters are talking about. Here's the message we want to get to them. It comes in this package, an ad. Let's see if voters respond to it. Is that right? And that you test a whole bunch of these messages, a whole bunch of these ads, and you find the ones that the data tells you are helping you the most, are moving the most voters.
So we made 1,050 ads for Kamala Harris for that effort, you know, from the, you know, 107 days or whatever it was before, you know, when she was a nominee. And that's a tremendous number. And the way we did that is that we worked with 20 different creative firms. You know, I think in one of those other stories that came out during the election, an anonymous participant in that process likened it to the Hunger Games. So
yes.
It didn't always produce the happiest partners, but it did, we think, produce the best results. You know, because as you know, in times past, you know, when you had an independent expenditure or super PAC, you often had, you know, a single pollster and a single, you know, media consultant. And we really want to kind of break that model and go with a very big approach one, it allowed us to create a tremendous amount of content quickly, which was, you know, a huge asset. And then allowed us to kind of find what was, you know, the cream of the crop. And the, you know, the good news is that all of those firms, you know, a lot of the firms we work with, almost everybody got usable stuff. You know, everybody creates good content. It's just finding the best of the best in the moment. And that process really, you know, really helped there. But it also wasn't the case. I sometimes hear this, that the idea that ad test, like somehow we're using ad testing that, oh, this ad did, you know, 4.54 and this one did 4.53. So we're going to run the 4.54. That's not how the process worked at all. You know, what we saw is, you know, you see, you know, basically you get, you know, if I have 1,000 ads, I'm going to look in the top 100 as all usable. And the question is, what fits the other research streams we have, you know, and what are we hearing from voters and focus groups? What are we hearing in our surveys? What are we hearing from all the things that we're testing in social media? What's working in the earned media environment? And really trying to have all of these separate streams coming in, and where we're hearing similar things and seeing similar impacts, that's where we have the most confidence. And, you know, as you know better than anybody, you know, presidential campaigns are about things, you know, and it's a national argument and you want to win that argument. And so, you know, when you look at the output of our, of all of that work, all of the ad creation, all of the, you know, the research we did across various streams, what we ended up with was feeling that, you know, what we heard from voters over and over again was, I don't like Donald Trump, but I'm open to voting for him if I think he's going to make my life better and lower costs. And so it really, in every forum, in every research stream, it was, we have to try to win that economic argument and say Kamala Harris is going to be better for you and your bottom line than Donald Trump. And if you go back and look at some of our ads, you know, what we have are kind of two main streams within that economic argument. One, we found from the jump that having Kamala Harris in her own words talking about what she was going to do to make voters' lives better was one of the most impactful things. And so we had a track of that. That was always in the mix for us. And then the other piece of it was, you know, real voters telling their stories and saying, you know, people who say, like, I voted for Trump in 2020, but I'm really concerned about his plan for tariffs. I think it's a national sales tax. It's going to hurt me and my family. I like what I'm hearing from Kamala Harris. You know, she wants to lower costs. She wants to give tax cuts to working class people. And, you know, those were our two main tracks. And so it wasn't this wonky campaign that was like paint by numbers of selecting the best ads. It was, what's fitting the theory of the case? What are we hearing from voters? And proceeding on that basis.
Right. So you weren't going and saying, okay, this ad is doing really well with 32-year-old women who are divorced and have children at home. Was it that
you, slicing and dicing? I mean, look, I think Amy, one of the extraordinary things about this election, and this is funny for someone who's, you know, experienced in 2012 and you know, was doing a lot of micro targeting in the consumer space, is that this was not a slice and dice election. You know, we saw consistently that, you know, cost of living, lowering costs, inflation were the driving concerns across every single subgroup. You know, Black, white, Latino, older, younger. This, you know, everyone really did have the same concerns. And that doesn't mean that you're not building media plans to reach those audiences where they are. And, you know, we ran ads in 9 different languages because, you know, not to sound like Yogi Berra, but like if they don't speak your language, they're not going to get your message. So you know, we did do a lot of things to make sure that we were getting the message. I mean, whenever you build an advertising campaign, your first responsibility, other than knowing the best way to communicate about the things that your targets care about, is matching your media plan to where they get their media. And so, right, you know, the being in different languages was part of that, being across all the different platforms was part of that. You know, I think one of the other big stories, undertold stories in this election, people talk a lot about TikTok, but people don't talk enough about YouTube, right? YouTube is I think the second largest media property in the world now.
So how much money did you all spend on YouTube? I mean, just roughly.
Oh, $60 million. Yeah. Enough to be the largest political advertiser by a large stretch.
Yeah.
There were weeks, Amy, in states where we spent more money on digital platforms like YouTube and others than all of the Republican advertisers put together.
So let's dig into that for a minute, because that's also one of the takeaways from this last election, is that Democrats got outplayed in these new platforms, whether it's TikTok or whether it's YouTube, and that the party hasn't figured out, the Democratic Party hasn't figured out how to talk to these voters in the spaces they live, in the way they talk. So I'd love for you to sort of address that, what you saw in there, and how you're thinking about it going forward.
Yeah, it's a billion-dollar question, and it's the right one. I mean, look, I think there's no question on social media, on the social media front, that we certainly didn't crack the code, and you know, hopefully we can talk more about, you know, some of the mistakes we made and things we're trying to fix. But you know, if I could go back in time, and boy, would I like to do it again. Give me another chance. You know, is that, you know, we did spend a lot of time. Our largest investments in 2023, when money was certainly, you know, much tighter than it was in August of 24. But our, you know, our largest investments were around social media and understanding. A lot of smart people across the system, you know, on our team and lots of other teams, were ringing the alarm bell and saying, you know, we're getting crushed here. And so it was a big animating concern. And so, you know, we jumped on that early, but it's also the type of thing where, you know, I wish I could have raised more money earlier in the cycle to do even more investments on a longer time horizon. Because I think one of the things that you get to is, you know, advertising is a very useful tool, but it's not a cure-all. You can't solve every problem, and you have just a limit on the amount of impact you can have with advertising in an election. You know, I think our you know, there was an independent analysis done by some of our donors in 2020, and they thought our, you know, $150 million ad campaign in that cycle was worth, you know, just under half a point on the margin. And so if you extrapolate that out and you consider for diminishing returns a bit, you know, $500 million, you're hoping for a point or a point and a half on the margin. And, you know, I had to go around and give these numbers to donors in real time during the election and say, that's what we're shooting for. And on the one hand, people want to say, you know, $500 million for a point to a point and a half on the margin. And you know, that's kind of some of the expectation setting that I think people need to wrestle with, is that having an impact in presidential elections, you know, you're really trying to move at the margins. Now, I, for one, think it's worth it, but I do think that there's, you know, that is just one of the realities. And so when you get back to the social space, it's a longer burn. So coming in with late money on, you know, in the influencer space, those relationships take time, and the relationships are really important. And, you know, we did see, and I think this has been reported and people covered this, there was obviously a big difference between the social media ecosystem when you had Biden at the top of the ticket, and then you got a ton of energy come in around Kamala Harris. And I think recency bias has obscured the fact of how great she was coming out of the gate, and how much energy and ebullience there was around her and her strong performance right out of the gate. But, you know, I think the number one place that donors and activists and all of us are focused right now is, you know, how do we show up in these platforms better? How do we build stronger relationships over time? You know, how do we move through these spaces? And there's a lot of components of that, right? There's, you know, the message you're trying to drive is important, but the, you know, the candidates you have, the people that you're going out there, are important, and the policies and the things you're speaking to are important.
My sense on YouTube, and I'd like to get your perspective on this, and part of the challenge, I think, in trying to figure out how to message on some of these platforms, whether it's YouTube or TikTok, is that so much of the conversation is organic around Donald Trump, that it wasn't that it was pure advertising where you would see a B-roll or something like that show up in your YouTube feed, but that the shows in which, or the programs in which these younger men especially were spending time on, talked about Donald Trump a lot, right? So he became, the advertising actually wasn't any about amount of money or an actual ad-tested message. It was, people are actually talking about him and saying things like, oh, he showed up at the, did you guys see him at McDonald's?
Yeah.
The French fries, right? So how much of that is, you know, unique to Donald Trump? And how much of that is that Republicans maybe did break the code or crack the code on how to operate in this new space?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I don't certainly don't have the definitive answer.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, you're interesting. It's interesting to see what's happening now, right? We're starting to see a shift. You're seeing more energy on the left. And so, you know, folks talk about, you know, TikTok especially, but some of these other platforms as a vibes machine, you know, like, and again, elections, this, we can zoom out a bit and say that this is true of elections too, which is, you know, how well do candidates fit the moment, right? And so, you know, Trump was certainly a, you know, a showman and one of the great manipulators and storytellers, you know, and there's many things. And we talked about this when it was CNN in 2016, the way he got CNN to roadblock his rallies. So he certainly is a uniquely talented character in that space, and that's part of it. There's also the fact that, you know, the driving concern has been, you know, we had runaway inflation, and you had a very unpopular incumbent administration, and you know, nothing drives people, you know, quite as insane as the cost of everything going up.
Right.
And so that's the atmosphere too. And so the organic content was against us. The real measure of whether someone can crack the code and control the weather is if the macro swings are actually against you, can you force your way through it? I'm pretty skeptical, and I think some things we're seeing now, where, you know, I think I heard the other day that, you know, the Midas Touch got more downloads than Joe Rogan. So watch out, you know. And so I think that the, you know, harnessing the moment, matching the moment, meeting the moment's a big part of it. That's not to say that we don't have lots of work to improve and to catch up with the Turning Point USA, you know, efforts. I think as usual, the answer is like it's a little bit of everything.
Right. Well, that leads to this question you talked about a little bit earlier about how important messaging on the economy was, since that was the issue that transcended all groups and every other demographic. There was, and I know you all can't coordinate with the Harris campaign, but there was clearly some tension there with, I think it was late in the campaign, there was a New York Times story saying that what you all were seeing, what Future Forward was seeing in its data, was that making the election about Trump's character, making it about this idea of fascism, the end of norms, was not as effective as talking about the economy. And of course, the Harris campaign, you know, closed on the ellipse with a message that did include the economy, but the backdrop clearly was, this is about democracy. Right. So what did you see that said, you know, making this about Trump and Trump's weaknesses and January 6th and he's a fascist, just it wasn't going to move the needle. And the other is this a lesson Democrats should continue to take over the course of these next 4 years, that trying to make Trump the issue is not going to get Democrats where they want to go?
Yeah. I mean, it's a durable learning going all the way back to 2016. I mean, we saw it in the retrospective on 2016, and we have, you know, alumni of that effort in the organization. We saw it again in 2020, where, you know, in a real idiosyncratic or inversion, as an outside group in that election, we spent the preponderance of our money on Joe Biden, on lifting up Joe Biden. We talked about Donald Trump very little in 2020 because the setup was everybody knew who then President Trump was and nobody knew who Joe Biden was, despite the fact that, you know, he'd been senator for 30 years and sitting vice president for 8 and had been a fixture of politics for so long. But you know, when you're in a presidential election, often the most important people are these low engagement people who do not follow politics and are not like us. You know, they're much more normal than we are. and so in 24, you know, and we certainly didn't just rest on that understanding from 20 and 16, because we looked at everything afresh and we really looked for ways to try to attack Trump and bring him down. And particularly in the time after the debate between Biden and Trump, it was like, well, can we find any value in trying to pin Trump down here in this moment? And the answer was no, kind of across the board. And so I do think, to your point, looking forward, one of the biggest lessons and the thing that, you know, that I will just come back to over and over again is that we just need to listen to voters. We really need to listen to voters as closely as possible. And I worry that we Democrats across the board didn't listen enough in the last couple of years, because voters weren't shy in telling us, you know, what their main concerns were. And the piece on the democracy and you know, the threat, you know, I totally understand the desire to raise the salience and how big the risk was, because the risk was so huge and we're seeing it play out in real time. And so I'm very sympathetic to that. I think what we just saw across our research was, you know, if you believed he was a threat to democracy, you were already with us. And if you were these low information, economically, you know, distressed folks who were really just narrowly focused on, we asked this question, a survey question, and said, you know, in the home stretch, what do you think is more important, preserving Americans' institutions or making change to improve people's lives? And it was, you know, 82 to 18, you know, and it just wasn't a driving concern for the people that we knew were going to be most important.
A quick break. We'll be back with Chauncey McClain. It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the last few weeks, we've rolled out our race ratings for governors, the House, and the Senate. It's not too early to think about next year's midterms, and we have everything you need to know about these races. But it's only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Join us. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. This still seems to me, Chauncey, like the fight that's happening within the Democratic Party right now, where now it's Republicans who are the incumbent party, but Democrats are fighting amongst themselves about how hard to fight Trump on the norm busting, including potentially shutting the government down to protest that. I'm curious your take on it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the thing I will say is that the fighting and the tension that we're seeing now in the Democratic Party is normal and healthy, right? I keep coming back to the Republican Party in 2013, right? when I would have much more happily done this interview, right? As you know, we were all conquering heroes then. But you know, I'm old enough to remember that the Republicans said, we're doomed. We're never going to win another presidential election. Demographics is destiny. This is going to become a minority majority country, and we're just on the out. And so I believe one of the first and biggest autopsies they did, they said, well, we need to get gentler and kinder and better to dreamers and immigration reform and all of these things. And then what happens?
And then 3 years Trump later, here's Donald Trump.
Yeah, Trump.
Yeah, and Bobby Jindal came out and said, you know, this is the, we got to stop being the stupid party at one point, right? So I absolutely hear you. And then I do wonder, though, to your point about why defending institutions didn't work. It seems to me that there were two issues. One, it's hard to defend institutions if you are worried about being able to feed your family. Totally get that.
Yes.
But there seems to be something else too, which is there are people who, they were frustrated with inflation, but really at their core, they are frustrated with the status quo at all yes. levels. And that Harris and Biden's messaging, which was we have to protect institutions, really rang hollow. Is that your sense as well?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's ironic now because now you're seeing some concern from Trump voters about what, you know, Musk and Trump are doing. You know, if for whatever reason people don't get social security checks on time or benefits get cut or anything, all of a sudden people are going to care about institutions again. Not in the like democracy or whatever. But I do think that to state the obvious, like the circumstances matter quite a bit. And I think when you had an incumbency that was really unpopular, again, I think largely due to inflation, saying, you know, this could be the end of democracy, it just didn't resonate in that moment that we were in. You know, another question we ask is everything fine right now and we just need continuation? You got like 3% support.
Right.
Do you think we need incremental change and stability in this moment? And it was like in the 30s. And like, do we need major change even if disruptive? And that was like 58%.
And you're saying this is among your sort of lower information voters, right?
That was actually across the board.
Oh, that was across.
Yeah,
okay.
That was actually across the board. If you just looked at that number among lower information people, you would have been even higher. Yeah, I mean, I think you said it, which is, you know, what has democracy done for me lately? Right? It's a high profile concept. I'm worried about whether I can, if I have a medical emergency, whether I'm going to be able to pay that bill, whether I can afford groceries, whether I can feed my family, like that. Those were the driving concerns.
And so are you all still doing the polling and the analytics at this point? Or what is your role in the off year, the world
yeah.
of future forward? Yeah.
What is future forward now? I mean, blessedly not the same as it was the last 2 years. You know, I think we're back to an organization like we were in 2019, which is, you know, perhaps with the important difference that, you know, we've built this research infrastructure. We feel like we're able to keep up with voters across a variety of different spaces, quantitative, qualitative, you know, both what's happening in the paid space, though not a lot's happening there, but also what's happening online and what's moving on social and what the most impactful messengers are and, you know, what's really working, and wanting to make sure that we just continue to connect that to, you know, every Democrat with a megaphone, with a microphone, whether you're elected, whether you're not elected. Because I think, again, the big takeaway for us is, you know, always trying to have the highest fidelity read on what voters think in real time.
So what are they telling you right now?
I think they're telling us that there's some real concern. I mean, the mandate, I would say, you know, I think we see this a lot, which is people get elected for reasons, you know, they run on things, and then voters, you know, quite understandably expect them to do those things. And so Trump ran on securing the border and lowering costs and making people's lives better. That's largely what he ran on. And you know, unfortunately, he does, in our research, and I think in a lot of other people's research, have a mandate to do a lot of things at the border, and in immigration policy generally that we might not like or feel is inhumane and unproductive in the long term. But voters elected him to do that and are not upset when they see him deploy military at the border, remain in Mexico, all of those things. That's what voters thought they were going to get from him. Now, one of his, but what they didn't elect him to do is he didn't run on putting, you know, Elon Musk in charge of ripping through the federal government with a chainsaw. And so even Trump voters, and you see some of this happening online and, you know, having Trump voters saying, wait a second, I thought he was a smart businessman and they were smart. You know, these were both smart businessmen. They were to go in and find the fat, not just obliterate everything. And now I'm going to get hurt, or I'm a Trump voter that lost their job, you know? And so his popularity is taking a hit, and the concerns around Musk and the kind of slashing of benefits is because that's not what they thought he was going to do. And so that's a risk for him. And then on the second piece, people really have high expectations that he's going to improve their lives economically, and he's going to lower costs. And so one, he's not off to a great start on that front, and the tariffs made people nervous going in, and they're only making people more nervous now. But if he doesn't focus really closely on that, the reason they sent him there, he's going to lose people, and he's going to get more and more unpopular. And so, you know, as norm breaking and strange and awful as many of these things are, some of the usual political rules are still applying to him, which is he has a mandate to do the things that he said he was going to do when he got elected on, and he doesn't have a mandate, and voters don't want to see him do things that they didn't expect he was going to do.
That's an interesting way to think about this too, which is it feels as if for Donald Trump, you said the rules are still applying, but it feels like he has defied political gravity time and time again. And you start to think, well, maybe on some of these issues, he's going to be able to massage his way through to protect his standing. But your point is, what you're hearing already is that people are feeling the tangible impacts on their lives, right? Or not feeling, as the
not
case
feeling.
May be.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Well, and look, he's been subject, it's right. He both things are true. He has been able to defy political gravity in innumerable ways, but he's also still been subject to it, right? The end of his honeymoon in 2016, or one of the most consequential things, is when they tried to cut Obamacare. People didn't like it. Like, people don't like it when you cut their benefits and things that they rely on. And so in trying to do that, his numbers went down. It was very, very predictable. And I think we will see a similar situation if people's lives don't improve. And look, I mean, Amy, I think the big conversation, I was having this conversation with Rick Davis after the election, and I think it's the big question still is this a durable coalition shift, right? We're all talking about young men, non-college educated voters of color voting for Trump. Is this a durable coalition shift? And to be able to live my life, I have to say, I don't think it's going to be durable. But the honest answer is, it's an open question. And my argument is it won't be durable if he doesn't deliver on what they asked for, right? And so if people's lives don't improve economically and they don't feel it, that's what drove him back to power here. And I think that's will put them in a really tough spot if they're focused on all of these other things and not only addressing, you know, people's concerns and high costs and the affordability crisis, but actually making them worse.
And kind of going back to that about what Democrats need to be talking about, beyond the Democrats are fighting amongst themselves piece, it seems as if they're also having a challenge about which of the things to talk about that Trump is doing that they hate. And some of the things that Democrats hate are not things that swing voters or less engaged voters or these other groups hate. So is it just that Democrats should have a maniacal focus on just make it about the economy? Just make it about these things are, you know, again, not upending the norms, not making this about Trump trying to be a king or, you know, all this other stuff.
Yeah. Look, I think I largely agree with that. I think we want to stay focused on if the reason we lost is because he won the economic argument, you know, at the end of the election by like a 12-point margin, people said he would be better for their bottom line than Kamala Harris. And now it's his, I think, potentially his Achilles heel if things don't improve and he doesn't fulfill his promise in that area, which is the big one. And so I do think that there's real value in staying focused there. But I'm also not saying, you can do several things at once, right? And I think it is still appropriate to stand up for communities and things that we believe in. And so you can do a little bit of both, but on the margin, if there's a scale, I would spend the preponderance of my time on voters' number one concern. But it wouldn't mean I would retreat wholesale from any other area. So I think there just has to be a balance.
Well, and to that point, I wanted to talk about the sort of way forward that some Democrats are talking about, which is we need to spend less time, they say, talking about identity politics. And that, you know, and ads like the trans immigrant one were incredibly effective at labeling Democrats the party of topics and issues that are not mainstream. Do you think that ad in particular was a driving force?
I think it was a good ad of the thousands of ads we tested. It was in the 70th percentile, so it was good, but it wasn't in the 90th or 95th or 98th. And those ads were all, you know, economic focused, you know, focus on the border, some things like that. I think some of the bite from that, you know, Kamala Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you, was less about, trans issues specifically, and more about Democrats care more about niche, you know, these like specific constituency issues rather than whether everybody can afford the cost of things. So I think its sharpest point there in the election was more of its economic implications and the priority implication. And so beyond that, it was certainly an ad that got a lot of coverage and got a lot of, you know, pickup, and it was sticky in that way. And there's always value in getting some stickiness. I mean, we see this in social media, right? Where there's a very much an inverse relationship between what gets reach and what's persuasive. And you really do, at least this is how I approach it, is you really have to start with reach. You know, if you need to get in front of people, that is the currency. And once you get people's attentions and you can get in front of people, then you can figure out how to get your most impactful message. But, you know, if you have the world's most impactful message, but no one's viewing it, it's not worth anything.
Right. Right.
I was just going to say, I think we want to make sure that we focus on here as we go forward is let's fight the war we're in, right? And that means, you know, the next big thing on the horizon, you know, other than the governor's races that are coming up this year, and you'll have some special elections, but, you know, on the horizon are the midterms. And so we shouldn't fight the 2024 election in 2026, nor should we fight the 2028 election in 2026, right? And so the composition of that electorate will be, more favorable, right? The fact that if 2024 had been a midterm electorate, we would have won it, you know? And so we should feel good about our chances going into 2026, given the composition of who's going to turn out. But we shouldn't win that election and feel like, oh, then we fixed all of our problems and everything is great because we just won, you know, which tends to happen. And then the other thing is that, you know, 2028, to state the obvious, is quite a long ways from now. And so the candidate... We shouldn't be saying, oh, the candidate we're going to pick in 28 should be the one that would have won in 24.
100%.
Because the world's going to change.
That's right. But how confident are you that the tools that you all used in 2024 are going to be as effective in 26 and in 28 at finding whether it's the message or the right or how to communicate on the right platform?
I'm very confident in our ability, and I don't mean Future Forward, I just mean the ecosystem generally, to understand what voters care about in nearly real time now.
In every one of these spaces, it's not like what you're learning from focus groups is different from TikTok, which is different from YouTube.
No, and that could change, right? But we have the ability to, to put our ear to the ground in all of these spaces. You know, we have the democratic ecosystem has the infrastructure necessary to know what's going on in all of these spaces. And it was true in 2024 that everybody across these platforms and across demographics and age groups all had the same driving concern. That will not always be true. That, you know, we will see different things. And then, you know, obviously I do think we have the most work to do as a party in the new social media spaces and saying, how do we show up best here? And I think that's a question for all of our candidates and all of our surrogates. And I am all for the work that's going to happen in terms of like building out more platforms and bigger audiences and personalities that are more favorable to us. I think that's important work. But also a big part of the work is just getting our people out on all of these platforms. Go to where the people are.
Like talk to people where they are. And that seems to be that seemed to be a challenge, because where the people are is increasingly not on linear television, of course, or cable or wherever else we think of as or the 2012 Obama campaign would have reached.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we are equipped to compete in all of those places. And I think we will do some of the infrastructure work necessary to make sure that we can increase our voice and our platform in some of those spaces. But then I also think it's you're seeing it from Democrats now. They all got their cameras out. You know, they're all going to go sit down with everybody. I think they got the message. And I think it's always the same way. I mean, it sounds so reductive, but the same way it's like, hey, make sure that we're always listening to voters and then going to talk to them exactly where they are. But also, you know, making sure that we are lifting up candidates and finding people who meet the moment that we're in. And, you know, I think you're already seeing some of that. I think you'll continue to see that.
You said you're polling thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Millions of people.
Yeah.
In 2024, was your data more accurate than the public polling that was out there? In other words, did you wake up the day after, or you probably didn't sleep like those of us who were up all night on election day, but were you surprised, or did your data tell you this was the likely outcome?
It was accurate. Forgive me for plugging another podcast on your podcast, but you know, David Shore did Ezra Klein yesterday, and I think that's worth a watch for everybody in terms of really deep dive into the numbers of the election, what happened. But the forecast from that team were very accurate. And I got in trouble maybe a little bit when I did the sit down with you and David Axelrod at the DNC convention, because you know, I said, you know, the polls were too rosy. The public polls were too rosy. So we consistently had the race as a 50-50, you know, as one which we could lose. And we consistently saw that, you know, what were these lower information voters, these, you know, sporadic people who didn't vote in midterms that we were having the most trouble with. So I do think this isn't a election we're coming out of like 2016 and even to some extent 2020, where people are like, oh, polling's dead, we can't measure. I think again, you know, we should always look at polling as and I had to remind myself of this, and I said this to the team the week before the election, like the forecast, the polling numbers we're looking at now are not the actual numbers. You look at them so often, you're like, oh, we're at 49.9 in Wisconsin. You're like, well, no, we're not at 49.9. It's not perfect. But, you know, the rank ordering of states that we had was that the team produced was exactly right, which is really impressive. And the fact that Sun Belt states were further away from us than the blue wall states, that had been consistent. And so I think the polling and the forecasting, at least in this election, was very good and certainly good enough to do what we needed to do, because we don't need a crystal ball and we're not going to get one. We just need to be able to make resource allocation decisions, and we need to be able to, you know, understand where we are. So I feel confident that's going to continue, and there'll be bigger misses in the future, I'm sure. But, you know, that's of the many things that, you know, keep me up at night now, that is not one of them.
So feeling confident then going into 2026 that you have the tools to give you the data to make the decisions.
That's right. That's right. And you know, again, I think in 26, you're going to see, this is what I mean when I say, like, let's make sure to fight the war we're in. The electorate for a midterm, as you know, is going to be more educated, more suburban, people who vote in midterms and don't vote, you know, and mayor's races and dog catcher races, right? Their media consumption habits are different than the presidential electorate. And I, you know, I'll bet you $10 right now that the Trump people are going to sound like the Obama people did in 2010, which is, you know, our goal, what we're going to do is we're going to get all these people who showed up for MAGA in 2024 and we're going to drive them out, you know? And it's like, good luck with that. You know, like that's, there are real gravity concerns. And you're not, if you're banking your midterm strategy on turning out people who don't turn out midterms, that's going to be a tough road to hoe.
It's rough. And so your point being, even if the platforms are changing, right, that those low information voters aren't watching television anymore, they're on YouTube, but their behavior is the same. So in 2010, those low information voters were sitting on a couch watching a TV. Today, they're logged on to YouTube, but they YouTube. Are not,
yeah.
That doesn't change the way they interact necessarily with midterm elections or with politics.
That's correct. Yeah. And I think, you know, you're always, again, you always want to start with reach. Like, where are the voters that are going to vote in this election? And then one layer down, where are the people that we think are, you know, the swing voters are most persuadable? Where are they spending their time? And then let's make sure we fan out across those platforms equitably, given who we're trying to reach. And then let's talk in ways and communicate in ways that are native and competent to those platforms.
Chauncey, is there anything else that we didn't get to talk about that you wanted to get off your chest?
Oh, I think you got it all.
I think we got a lot of stuff.
Okay. Well, thanks for you know, it being my first podcast, I might even do another.
Wow. So okay. Well, yeah. I think you've got it down. You figured out this whole podcast thing. we had a little technical difficulty at the beginning, but you handled it.
That's true.
Swimmingly. So I think you could do another one.
Well, Amy, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And look forward to catching up again soon.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.